This is the Bischoff on Wrestling podcast, featuring former WCW president, WWE Raw general manager, one half of Bischoff Hervey Entertainment, and New York Times best-selling author, Eric Bischoff. Now, here's WrestleZone Radio and 120 Sports' Nick Houseman, and your host, Sports Entertainment's King of Controversy, Eric Bischoff.
Hello, everybody. Once again, Eric Bischoff with you on Bischoff on Wrestling. You can check us out on iTunes and audioboom.com. All right, Hulk. First of all, thanks for being on the podcast. It really means a lot to me. I was really uncomfortable asking because I don't like to ask friends for favors if I can avoid it at all. But, you know, the wrestling fans are really interested in hearing, you know, where your head's at and what you're up to now and, you know, just your thoughts on wrestling. And we're gonna cover all of that, you know, in the next hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, however long we keep having fun. But given the passing of Mr. Fuji recently, I never got a chance to work with him or have the privilege of meeting him. But I know you got a lot of history. You know, what are your thoughts on Mr. Fuji?
Well, you know, before we go there, brother, you know, you and I go back way, way back to the original sin. And the original sin was when I was pretty much out of wrestling and everything was hands-off, you know, and Hulk Hogan wasn't supposed to be acknowledged. You stepped up and said, hey, brother, how'd you like to rock and roll? And I'll never forget Orlando. And I know I've said this to you in private, but if it wasn't for Eric Bischoff, I pretty much would have walked away and stayed away at that time because Vince McMahon thought the Hulkamania run was over and done. I was doing Thunder in Paradise, and I missed wrestling so much that when you gave me the opportunity and the chance to get back in, when no one else believed in me, and I got to give credit to Bill Shaw also for approving your judgment, that's the original sin, to drag me back in it. So I'm forever indebted to you just to clear that up because nobody's ever really heard that from me publicly. That's been a private bond between us, but the situation with Mr. Fuji was, you know, I didn't even call him Mr. Fuji. We called him Uncle, you know, and sometimes we call him Uncle Harry, but we had a great time, a great run being around each other, and I looked at him as the calmer head, you know, because as all the craziness was going on back in the day when we were making towns and everything was real territorial, the guys would speculate, oh my gosh, this and that, what if this happens? And Mr. Fuji was always, Uncle Harry was always the calmer head, and he kind of like kept things in perspective, and he'd say, okay, Hulk, don't worry about this, you know, this is what's going to happen. And he really had a good train of thought or a good, you know, wrestling theory to predict, you know, direction and basically careers and guys like me who were kind of like listening to all the chatter around me. Uncle Harry would kind of set me straight. For some reason, he took a liking to me. So I pretty much wasn't the direct objective of his ribs, but I was around when he did a lot of stuff. And I happened to move into West Haven, Connecticut in about early 1978, and I missed the crazy rib with Torquemada and the cat and the beef stew. And thank God I missed that rib. But, you know, the overview was Fuji was a great guy. He was real insightful, and he kind of like held it down, you know, as things started to ramp up with Vince Jr. and Vince Sr. was still in control. Uncle Harry kept a real cool perspective for all of us that weren't sure exactly what was going to happen. But he was a great guy, and I was shocked that he passed.
You know, you brought up Mr. Fuji's ribs, and I hate when people ask me, you know, what's the funniest story you've ever heard, or you know, what's the funniest thing you've ever seen backstage? Because honestly, I can never remember a good joke. I can never remember the end of movies, generally speaking. I can enjoy the heck out of them, but I'd be damned if I could remember things like that. But do you recall any ribs with regard to Mr. Fuji that really stand out in your mind?
Well, it was, like I said, it was the one that I missed. It was the legendary rib of all ribs, where there was a wrestler named Torquemada that was good friends with Fuji, and they were partners for a while. And then I know he must have done something to Fuji. I don't know the whole story. But at the end of the day, there were a bunch of guys up in West Haven, which is exit 42. You know, the office was always on Summer Boulevard down there in Stanford. And, you know, it was around exit 6 or 7. They finally, I think, moved the office to exit 9 where it's at now. But if you go way up 95 to 42 West Haven, there was an apartment complex that myself and the Iron Sheik and Bobby Duncan, the Samoans, Rick McGraw, Stan Hansen was there, Rick Martel, Mr. Fuji and Toro Kamado were there. And at the end of the day, I missed the rip, but the legendary rip was, you know, Toro got on Fuji's bad side. You know, Fuji, the Samoans and Fuji liked to barbecue, and it was some type of dish. I don't know if it was a stew or whatever it was, but after all the boys had eaten, you know, Fuji came out and had the head of the cat that was in the stew, and all hell broke loose. And I'm so glad I wasn't around for that. I did not see it. I'm not sure of the details, but that was the rib of all ribs that always stood out with Fuji. And then there was the trickle-down effect from, you know, stuffing people's drinks and, you know, going to the bathroom in people's gym bags and locks and just, you know, canceling airplane reservations for a whole crew. He'd stay up all night canceling airplane reservations. And, you know, with Mr. Fuji and Mr. Perfect up in heaven, I'm sure there's a lot of joking and ribs going on right now. I can assure you that.
That was just going to. I'm glad I missed that whole scene with the cat too. I don't know how that would have left some serious scar tissue. I may not have ever gotten over.
Yeah.
But I mean, you mentioned Kurt Hennig. I mean, Kurt, who I did know and get to work with, but has that reputation or had that reputation of just being a master ribber. You know, if you had to compare the two, who do you think would get the crown, Mr. Fuji or Mr. Perfect?
Well, I mean, you know, Mr. Perfect was more consistent. It was 24/7 with him, you know, and I'd probably have to give it, you know, to Kurt, because Kurt was right during my era, and, you know, Fuji was kind of like winding down, you know, those last few years when I was really winding up during the mid-80s. So I get to see a lot of the Kurt Hennig stuff, you know. And the funny part was Kurt would do most of the damage, and then the Nasty Boys would get most of the heat for it. So I'd have to give props to Kurt for being more consistent and more, you know, dialed in.
Well, the fact that he could pull the rib and fade the heat over to the Nasty Boys and they'd have to take it probably would pull him over the line for just about anybody, because that's taking the whole art to a different level altogether. It's one thing to do something that's humorous and funny and really ribbing somebody, especially if they deserve it. It's another thing to make sure the heat lands on somebody else. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of like looking back at all this stuff, I really didn't realize how much it really meant, you know, as far as bonding us all together. Looking back on this stuff, I just really didn't know what I had at the time, you know, especially when I think about, you know, Kurt Hennig. I mean, he was up and down between the Intercontinental situation, tag team situation, you know, main event situation. And looking back on Kurt, I just didn't realize how lucky I was to have this guy to work with, you know. And one of the things that really made me, you know, sit back and think, you know, after his passing was that last match I had with him. I actually went over to Orlando because there was a whole independent thing called the XWF going on, and Lawler was there, and Sable, and the Road Warriors, and Mr. Perfect, and Macho Man, and Mean Gene Oakland. I mean, everybody that was everybody was starting up this little independent thing, and I was just going over there to watch, and I was going to do a photo shoot for whatever the heck it was, Legends of Wrestling, or one of those independent things I was doing, you know, a DVD release. And I was over there, and I was, you know, I had my boots on, and I had all the yellow stuff on, and my son Nick was very young then. And Kurt came in, and he goes, "Hey, what's wrong, old man? You afraid to get in the ring?" And I had no plans of wrestling. I just had one of my several knee surgeries, and you know, still was pretty much stitched up and wasn't really ready to go. And I said, "Okay, I'll wrestle you." And we went out, and without even talking, I barely got to the ring in time when they were announcing my name. I was tearing off an old XWF shirt, a black shirt instead of a red and yellow Hulkamania shirt, and Kurt led me around the ring like I was a babe in arms. I mean, I didn't need to see or hear or touch or feel. He was so good that he walked me around that ring for that TV match, the 8 or 9 minute TV match, and he made me look like I was King Kong. I mean, he had a knack for being able to switch gears and work with anybody. And until now, watching the wrestling on TV now, seeing how it's all transpired, I really, really appreciate guys like Curt Hennig and how good he really was. I don't think too many people really realize when you get in the ring with somebody and it's smooth like butter, everything rolls along perfect, that doesn't happen very often anymore. And I just really appreciate and miss him. And I definitely miss him, that laugh, the gargling, the Jack Daniels all the time, always being in a good mood. I mean, he was something really special.
He was, and, you know, I actually knew him in AWA when he...
Anyway, he was a Robbinsdale boy, too.
And he was a Robbinsdale boy.
He was straight from that tough, hardcore faction from Minnesota.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, he went to high school with my wife, along with Rick Rude and, you know, a lot of the guys, and we all kind of hung out in some of the same areas, so I didn't go to school with him. I certainly knew who they were and associated with him a little bit. But when you look back at Curt, and you're talking about, you know, what a gift he had... and not many people have that, but there's, I made a statement, actually I posted it on Twitter. It was just like a conscious thought that I had that I just felt the need to share for some bizarre reason. And no, there wasn't any alcohol involved or anything like that, but it's like, you know, it's one thing to understand something. It's quite another to feel it. And it's hard to articulate the difference, but a guy like Curt Hennig had a feel that to me separated him. And I think Ric Flair has that too, that has that feel that's, you can't teach it. You're either born with it, you know, it was a gift from God. You're either just like, I guess, being a great musician, even though it takes a lot of practice. Some people just have a feel for it. Do you think that's true with Curt?
Oh yeah. He definitely had the feel for it. I mean, you know, you can say what you want about people's work rate, you know, technical or entertainment wise, but the one thing about this business is, you know, the cream always rises to the top, and you know, some guys have, you know, a run that might be for a couple of years in main events or tag teams. Some guys have runs like The Undertaker that last for decades, and you know, different people have these long runs, but Curt had that feel, you know, and at any time he could bounce from one point to another point on the card. And the great part about him was he taught you every time you get in the ring. I mean, you know, my last tenure, you know, with the WWE, I would sit, you know, like it was like when I was with WCW, and I'd watch these guys talk for 4 hours about a four-minute match on TV. And the one thing about Curt was he would listen if you wanted to talk, but basically once the red light came on, he had that feel. And it didn't matter what you talked about. Curt would deviate if he had to, or he would just throw the whole conversation out. But you could always depend on Curt to do the right thing, to make things match, to make things work, to make sure you ended up in the right spot you were supposed to be in when that bell rang in the end. And that was over. Whether you won or lost, Curt made you more over at the end of that match than before you went in. And it was all about feel. It was all about timing. And it's instinct, and not a lot of guys have that instinct.
Do you think part of that, and part of the reason we don't see people develop that instinct is because, as you pointed out just a few moments ago, you've got that pressure of a four-minute match or a six-minute match, and you're trying to cram so much in and be aware of the hard cameras. Do you think that guys really don't get a chance to develop that instinct if they're blessed enough to have it?
I think it goes beyond that. I think that's a big part of it, you know, but to really get religious about this thing, it's got to be in your blood. I mean, for you to really have that instinct, it has to be part of your DNA. It has to be part of your spirit. Curt really didn't have much of a choice because he was the Axe. His dad was a wrestler before him. I don't know if anybody before the Axe was in the business in his family, but he grew up in it. It was part of his DNA. I mean, he had it in his blood. And, you know, a lot of guys now get in the wrestling business because, oh, my gosh, I watched The Rock or I watched John Cena or I was a huge Macho Man fan. They get in the business and they watched Hulk Hogan or Andre the Giant. They get in the business and they really want to do it, to become a wrestler and they love it, or they want to make money, or they want to be a WWE diva or WWE superstar. But there's not a lot of guys that have the DNA in their blood. And let me turn this phone off, sorry. But that's what I think.
That's a hell of a ringtone you got there, brother.
Yeah, I know. That's what I think made him really special.
You think Kurt, and I know this isn't about Kurt Hennig, we got a million miles of ground to cover here, but you know, one of the matches that I used to watch a lot over and over and over again early on was Kurt Hennig and Nick. You know, I mean, those two guys in AWA had such – Nick Bockwinkel, I'm sorry – had such phenomenal matches, and the chemistry between those two, at least from my perspective then, and even years later when I would go back and rewatch it from time to time. You think Kurt learned a lot of his skill set from Nick as opposed to the axe?
Well, he grew up watching him. I mean, Kurt Hennig grew up as a little kid in Minnesota watching Nick Bockwinkel wrestle every week. So he, it was shoved down his throat. He didn't have a choice but to dance with a guy and for the dance to be perfect. It was, he could have closed his eyes and he was as one with Nick Bockwinkel. There was just so much more connection between those two guys than most of the matchups nowadays. Most of the matchups nowadays are real mechanical, real contrived. You know, the writers match things up, or Vince writes things up, or Eric Bischoff writes things up, or Dixie Carter, whoever. But these connections were inherent. They were inbred. This connection with Kurt and Nick Bockwinkel was something that was just like when it rains, the grass grows. That's what happened. You know, it was raining, and you know the rain was Nick Bockwinkel, you know, wrestling as AWA champion. And Kurt Hennig happened to watch it from the time he's a little boy, and he just grew up to be a big, tall drink of water, a big, tall piece of grass. It was so organic. He had no choice but to rock and roll with the guy.
And I know this is always a tough question I get, and I apologize for asking it because sometimes it's just so hard to answer. But if you look at the landscape now, as it is today, as we're in this moment, as we're on this call, who do you see that level of potential in? Maybe not as much potential as a Nick Bockwinkel or Kurt Hennig, but who do you see out there that in the corner of your eye you're watching them and go, wow, I bet you this person could be the next whomever? Who do you see out there that may have it?
I mean, that's tough. You know, I really don't kind of look at it that way because that just really doesn't exist. I kind of, when I watch it, you know, I kind of like wait for something to come out that just seems so natural to me. It doesn't matter about the size. It doesn't matter about the shape. You know, it really doesn't matter. There's you know, people that have natural heat or that are naturally over or have a natural look or they walk in a room and they command a presence. And it, as weird as that sounds, one of the guys, when I was in the WWE before they let me go, one of the guys that I told Triple H, I don't know if he was on anybody's radar or anybody was watching him, but one of the guys that you would never expect Hulk Hogan to point out was Kevin Owens. And I told Triple H, I said, this kid, Kevin Owens, you know, no matter how he looks physically, no matter what you think about him, when he walks out, he's over in such a weird way. He's got natural heat, you know, and when he gets in the ring, I watched him work on an NXT match, and he was just grinding old school like a heel, getting the heat, staying on the guy, letting the guy sell, walking away, going back to the dance, keeping his heat. And then when it was time for the babyface to come up, I watched the babyface try to come up several times at the wrong time. Kevin had enough instinct to cut him off. And then when he did let him come up, he was backpedaling like a Pat Patterson or like a Hollywood Hogan or a real big chicken shit heel. And he was over so well as a heel, I told Triple H, if you get this guy up and running, he could turn into one of your greatest baby faces. But I don't really look at who's the next guy, who's the next big thing anymore. I'm more looking for a transition when I look at these guys, like who could be the guy that figures it out first. And once you figure it out, that person's like a dark horse. Well, Kevin Owens, believe it or not, you know, he's not a Brock Lesnar, you know, he's not an Ultimate Warrior. He might be the next big thing. I kind of look for hope, you know, instead of pointing my finger and saying, that's the guy. We're way beyond that now. You know, these wrestlers are like interchangeable parts. I look at a guy where I see a lot of hope that he could break this cookie cutter menu that you know people have now to choose from and break through and change the game again. And a guy like Kevin Owens shows me that hope spot that no matter how much TV you have to shoot, no matter how many towns you have to make, how these guys work their rear ends off, here's one guy that'll put it back on track and make it easier for everybody to figure it out. So I'm looking for these guys with a hope spot instead of who the next big thing is, because I can't put my finger on who the next big thing is.
It's an intangible, isn't it? I mean, sometimes, like you're right, it just takes that moment, the kind of nexus of opportunity and passion and all of the above, and it just happens. And it is really hard until you get to know somebody and get to know them on a personal level and an artistic level. You don't really know if that intangible passion, that DNA that you talked about earlier is there. I know you were excited about Kevin Owens. You tweeted it out the other night when he won. I know how you feel about him, you know, clearly, and I'm excited to hear that. But what do you think not that you could possibly know, because you came up a little differently than he did, but what do you think is going through his mind right now? Because he came from the indie scene, came up relatively soon, relatively quickly through the WWE system, and now he's earned that spotlight. He's earned probably a solid career, you know, providing he doesn't get hurt. For a guy to work that hard, get that kind of recognition from the WWE, which is the biggest stage on the planet, what do you think is going through his head?
Well, I know he's going to make the most of the opportunity. I know that firsthand from asking him. At the end of the day, it all depends on how well he figures the game out. You know, it's like Booker T used to say, don't hate the player. You know, just somebody like Brock Lesnar or Hulk Hogan gets a big break. Booker T used to say, don't hate the player, hate the game. Because at the end of the day, this wrestling business, as much as you know, do or don't want to admit it or may not understand it, or all these smart marks really don't get it. Oh, well, Hogan's a politician, or he's a politician, or, you know, John Cena's a politician. The truth is, this business is about relationships on every level and being, if you want to be a main event guy, if you want to be consistently, you know, figuring in the main events for 20 or 25 years or however long you want to do it, you got to be a great politician. You got to be a politician in the ring. You got to be a politician in the dressing room. You got to be a great, smart politician when you're working with Vince and Triple H. You got to be a politician when you're out in public, especially. You got to be a politician when you're with a group of men or a group of women. It's all about, you know, having that finesse to really make sure in every different situation that you understand the game. Now, I don't know how much Kevin understands the overall game, but that has a direct influence on how long he's going to become a dominant or stay a dominant force in this business. He has to understand the game. And if, you know, you don't like Kevin Owens and he rises to the top and becomes bigger than The Rock or Hulk Hogan or Stone Cold or anybody, don't be hating Kevin Owens. Hate the game, because he figured it out. So that's what's going to determine his run or if he makes history or not.
And by the way, for anybody out there, and hopefully there's a lot of independent wrestling fans out there, I just met a bunch of them over in the UK this past week. But for fans or someone listening who may be in the WWE system or hope to be in that system someday, the advice that you just gave about being a politician, and by the way, you can be a politician, you can be a diplomat, you can be gracious. In every way that, Hulk, you just mentioned, I'm just taking out the word politician because sometimes it comes with negative references, but, you know, being able to be a diplomat in all of those ways, in the ring, in the locker room, dealing with Vince and Triple H, out in public, you know, in different types of group settings, being able to carry yourself as a professional and be a diplomat and be proud of your sport or your business is phenomenal advice from a guy who's seen many come and many go. So I appreciate that, and I hope everybody else does.
Yeah, well, I mean, I use the word politician because you can take it out as gracefully as you want, but the truth is, being a politician isn't a bad thing. I mean, the only people that brand somebody, oh, he's a politician or he plays politics, those are the ones that are haters or they just don't understand the business. And at the end of the day, to be Triple H, to be The Rock, to be Hulk Hogan, to be Stone Cold, you got to be a good politician. And basically, it's, you know, if you really want to make it work, you got to stay true to your gut, you know, and know when to hold them, know when to fold them, know when to push hard against Vince and, you know, try to back him up, or you know when to gracefully get your point across. There's a lot that comes to staying on top or staying figured in, and there's a lot more to it than just getting in the ring and having a 4 or 5 star match.
Cool. Now we're closing in on about 10 minutes of this first episode, but there's a couple things that I want to cover, so that are relatively recent. Let's start with the Brock Lesnar Randy Orton match at SummerSlam. What's your initial take on that?
My initial take, I didn't see it. You know, I didn't see the match. You know, the overview that I got from it was, you know, two things need to be accomplished. Brock Lesnar needed to make that transition and come back to the WWE after, you know, jitterbugging back and forth between UFC, and come back and be stronger than he was before. Thank God he won, you know, the match, the UFC match. If he'd have lost the match and then come back, I don't know. Maybe it wouldn't make any difference, maybe it would, but, you know, when he came back, it was real important that he had that mystique, or a bigger mystique. And then when I saw the match booked, you know, Randy Orton had a great chance, you know, to capitalize on whatever momentum Brock had, you know, and really make this thing work. The only thing that I really got to look at was the finish. And, you know, it was something that was unexpected. And it took a lot for Randy to Orton to step up for that finish. And nothing but respect for that. Nothing but respect.
Now, it got, and I talked about it before, and my take is similar to yours in the sense that I like the fact that it was unpredictable. It kind of got my attention. You know, it fell out of that normal course of business pattern that we expect to see. So I didn't have as big of a problem with the actual finish as I did with where that match was positioned on the show. And one of the things that you taught me when you first came to work for WCW and we first started doing pay-per-views that were starting to work a little bit, because we had to dig, you know, all of us, not just you and me, and, you know, there was a lot of people that had to try to dig WCW out of the sewage and try to get people to start caring about our pay-per-views. But one of the things that you taught me, which was a formula that you learned, you know, in your first run with WWE, was to leave them happy on a pay-per-view and on a house show, is what you used to tell me. Always leave them happy. And my only question was, if you're going to put together a finish like that, that is, it's awkward, you know, it's kind of it's very creative. It's risky as hell, because you're going to leave people kind of not sure how to feel because it's different. But do you think it was a mistake leaving that match to end the show?
Like I said, I didn't see the match, and I really don't have a feel of it. I know the difference between what we were doing and where they're at now. And, you know, one of the things that Vince, you know, always would say to me was he was looking for an attraction. You know, I'm always looking for that attraction. And sometimes when you don't have an attraction, things change, and you know, the whole landscape has changed with wrestling. And it's whether you don't have an attraction or whether you want to be, you know, spread the wealth and paint the pay-per-view with broader strokes, you have 2 or 3 main events. Well, we weren't really, back in the day, focused on that so much. So whether we had a heel chasing the belt or we had the baby faces chasing the heel, we would try to leave the thing open-ended where it would end on a high note. You know, whether it was leaving them happy, which I remember saying it on several occasions, but always trying to leave on a high note. I think there's a shock value if that's how they ended, because I don't even know the order. If you're telling me it was the last match, you know, Vince is a smart fox. You know, he's doing it for a reason. I don't even know if there's a rematch with that thing coming up. I'm not sure, but it's perfect, you know, for Brock Lesnar's style. you know, to set this thing up for a rematch. So not knowing the direction or if there is a rematch or if there's been one announced, I can understand it for that reason. You know, to go in that direction and have the hard way be the finish, that's a whole nother commitment, you know, on Randy's part.
Randy Orton was there in WWE when I first came to WWE in 2002, and he was really young then. And I don't know how long he had been there when I got there, but he was relatively he was still a rookie in many respects. But from the get-go, he was another one of those guys. I can't really say I can put him in a Kurt Hennig category or Ric Flair category necessarily yet, but he was one of those guys that just seems to have that magic something, isn't it? I mean, I felt that way. Do you?
Well, all the stuff looks good. Everything looks good that he does. He's got the timing down. You know, his instincts are perfect. He knows positions. He knows where he's at, you know, the physical positioning in the ring. He knows where he's at all time without having to go out there during the day and say, I'm going to land here, and then you jump on me here and push me into the corner here. He already knows where he's at without going through all that. And like I said, it's in his DNA. You know, I wrestled his father. I wrestled his grandfather. I mean, he comes from a long line of wrestlers, so it's inbred. So he's always had it. I mean, when I worked with him at a SummerSlam, we didn't even have to talk. We just knew the finish, and we went out, and I don't know how long the match went, but, you know, it was like a day off being out there with him. You know, when he connects with everything, you know he's there, but he's just on point every time in every situation.
And they are, by the way, doing a rematch at a house show in Chicago, I believe, on September 24th. So, you know, those fans in Chicago are going to get a chance to see that match up close and personal. And I would imagine it'll be hard to find a ticket for that one. That should be a great one.
Oh, it'd be great, man. We should fly up there and sneak in the back. Maybe go sit up in a suite and watch it. Nobody will know we're there.
I could sneak in. I don't think I could sneak you in. But, brother, that's one of the things, you know, listeners, you know, they all know, you know, you're a larger-than-life character in the ring, you know, but you're also larger-than-life outside of the ring. And, I mean, like, I want that's got to be hard. We'll talk about that in the next episode. But a guy like you, you can't just put on a hat and a pair of sunglasses and an oversized coat and kind of keep your chin down and hunk your way through Walmart, you know, when nobody without anybody noticing you. I mean, George Clooney was just here in Cody, Wyoming yesterday, and hardly anybody knew it because he's just an average guy. And like I said, you put on a pair of glasses, you throw down a big hat and a coat that's two sizes too big, and nobody will pick you out of the crowd. You can't pull that off.
No, I mean, you know, it's to the point now where, you know, thank God it's still happening. You know, I was out to dinner last night, and, you know, it was kind of amazing because my wife and I went to a new restaurant, and we went out to dinner last night, and this one guy came up, and he had a group of people, and he goes, I've never asked for an autograph before, you know, but I run a huge restaurant in Chicago, and we've got all these celebrities that come in, this, that, and the other, but I just got to ask you for an autograph. And it was such a compliment because he named the list of celebrities that came in his restaurant. And it was just such a compliment that he came over, and he goes, you can't hide anywhere you go. And I said, you know, you're right, the bald head and the mustache and, you know, walking around, the face and the bald head is so recognizable. I thank God for it because at this point in my life, at my age, 63 years old, for people to still come up, treat me like I'm the champion, excited to see me, it didn't have to happen this way, you know, especially after all the craziness I've been through. The fans are so loyal. It's just amazing how they still respond, and I'm grateful for it.
All right, we're going to wrap things up for this show, but at next week's show, I want to talk to you about AJ Styles, because you and I both had a chance to work with him, and John Cena, someone we both have had a chance to work with a little differently, but we're going to get into that next week right here on Bischoff on Wrestling. Thanks for listening.